Hello, this is Jim Wallace, and you're listening to The Soul of the Nation, a podcast about how our faith should shape our politics and not the other way around. Today on the podcast, we are doing something a little different. Instead of asking the questions, in this episode, I am going to try and answer them. I have written a new book, my 13th. It's called The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. It launches April 2nd. You can pre-order it now on Amazon and elsewhere, and I believe it's my most timely and perhaps important book. Today, I will be joined by Daniel Burke, the Communications Director at the Center on Faith and Justice at Georgetown University, where I am the founding director. Daniel is the former religion editor at CNN, so he is used to asking good questions, sometimes hard questions, and I will do my best to answer them. The conversation will center around my new book, The False White Gospel.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's good to be here. And just to jump right into it, I'm going to start by asking the question that you so often ask guests. And of course, you know you can take it in any direction, political, spiritual, personal. But how is your spirit these days?
That's a good question. I ask it all the time, but I've never had to answer it. So I'm going to go back to what my mentor, Desmond Tutu, taught me about the difference between optimism and hope. Optimism is a feeling or a mood or even a personality type, cup half full. I'm not always optimistic as I listen to the news and watch what's happening in this election season. Every day isn't an optimistic one. I'm sure many of our listeners feel that too. But he taught me that hope is a decision. It's a choice based on what we call faith. I have to say, Daniel, the preparation for this book tour has had to drive me deeper into my own faith. This is about faith and politics, but it's really about not just a theology of democracy, but for me, a spirituality that I've been drawn deeper into. Finally, I go back to that Psalm 46 text often every day now. Be still, be still, and know that I am God. I believe in God, and I have to keep claiming that for myself in these days, no matter what happens. Our worst fears, our best hopes, I need to trust my life in God. So I'm getting to that place as I begin to launch this 12-city book tour in 2.5 weeks. But yeah, I think my spirit is in that sense hopeful. I'm aware of the dangers more than any time in my history, my lifetime, or really since the Civil War in this country. But I'm also now claiming hope, and that's how I want to move forward and want to encourage my wider community to move forward too.
You mentioned the upcoming book tour and the preparations. This is not your first book. You've written 13. I'm kind of curious. Do you remember the title of your first one?
Oh, my first book. Yeah, it's called was called Agenda for Biblical People, red cover, and in those days it was so different. The head of a publisher wrote to me and said, "Hey, are you thinking about a book or interested in a book? We'd be interested in publishing this." HarperCollins. No author gets that these days. So I was very fortunate that he reached out to me and asked if I was interested in doing a book. And I said, sure. That was the first one, Agenda for Biblical People. And the one that followed that is the one that a lot of people read a long time ago called The Call to Conversion. The Call to Conversion. So this is, in a sense, another call to conversion at a critical moment in the history of religion and politics in America.
Yeah, it's striking the agenda for biblical people that could almost be the subtitle of your new book. But let's talk about the new book, The False White Gospel. First of all, that's a striking title. What do you mean by that? What is the false white gospel?
Well, this book, Daniel, as you point out, is really an interrogation of faith at a critical moment of both religion and politics in America. Some think that the answer to bad religion is no religion. And there are some days, I confess, I think that too, when bad religion gets so bad. But I really think the answer to bad religion is better faith, true faith. And for me, that's always a return to Jesus and the teachings of Jesus, which apply to Christians, but also many people find them very instructive. So, the false white gospel is white Christian nationalism, which I think is a chief obstacle to democracy, and in particular, a chief obstacle to multiracial democracy. And I think the name spells the problem. First, it's white. We have the most inclusive, welcoming vision in the history of the world in the gospel of Jesus Christ. Yet this is white. Christian, but they don't mean, you know, service and sacrifice and love. It's really dominance and control. It's the old dominionist theology in Christian history, which isn't new, but is coming back in a big way. That's not Christian. And then nationalist. I mean, Jesus, I'm getting old now, but I wasn't there at the Great Commission, but I read about it. And Jesus said to his disciples as he ascended into heaven, he said, go into all the world and make disciples in every nation, teaching them to observe whatever I have commanded you. Nationalist? No. This is for all of us and all the nation. So I'm trying to say we need to get back to where we belong. And for Christians, it's we belong following the words and teachings of Jesus.
You mentioned white Christian nationalism. You've also written a book about America's original sin, white supremacy. And I'm wondering how white Christian nationalism links up with America's original sin. It sounds like a very old thing with a new name, white Christian nationalism.
Yeah, I did write that book, America's Original Sin. And I've often quoted, in fact, in this book, again, quoted Bryan Stevenson, who wrote the foreword to that book, that slavery didn't end, it just evolved. And he talks about how it's evolved in the criminal justice system with a disproportionate impact on people of color. And I think America's original sin is reaching a crescendo now. Or as I talked to Brittany Packnett just last night, wonderful activist and dear friend, and she said, we had a conversation, she said, I think this white racism, white supremacy, white privilege is now fighting for its life, she said, fighting for its life. So it's either going to win this battle and set us far back, or it's going to lose this battle. And if that happens, it could open up a whole lot of new possibilities. Eddie Glaude wrote the foreword to this book, and I love his line, which is in the book. He says, everything is collapsing, and everything is possible, both at the same time. And that strikes me as where we're at. This is a moment. This is a Kairos time in the Bible, a time that changes lots of things, not just the Kronos, tick-tock, but Kairos, a moment that can change everything. And that's what we're facing now in the next several months with an election. Now, it's going to continue after the election, but it's a crescendo. It's a fighting for its life. America's original sin is fighting for its life. And there's so many people who want to repent of that sin, which means not just feel guilty and sorry and blame people. It's turning around. It's going in a whole different direction. That's what repentance means in Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. So I feel that hunger to go forward, but this is a concerted attack, a strategic attack on every level. Those who falsely said this last election was stolen, there's no evidence for that. They're trying to steal this election. And I would say, Daniel, in defense of America's original sin.
You raise a really, really important question that I've run into, that people I know have run into, who do live in in a place like Washington, D.C., where there's people who work on all sides of the political aisles, right? You at soccer games and other places, you run into people who work for Republican congressmen and Democratic congressmen. But as you say, as the fight for democracy seems almost existential, mm-hmm. and you see your friends and neighbors on one side of the fight and you find yourself on another, these are really difficult moments to navigate. And so I wonder, as you know, have you run into that in your own family and friends? And how do we tell the difference between those we want to defeat and persuade?
That's such a good question. And I'll be trying to answer that question in the weeks ahead with this book in hand. I had a little case study of that last week. I went to Florida. My son Jack had his Haverford College baseball team down there for spring training. So we're watching games with lots of other parents and fans, and who probably differ politically. And then in the little hotel we were staying at, there were these folks out by the pool, and Joy likes to sit by the pool, and she'd get talking to them, not knowing what their politics were. So it was a little case study of all of this. And it was interesting because when people would, you know, ask what I'm up to, what I'm doing, or I wouldn't press all this, but they kept asking, what are you doing? And so the book would come up. And it was interesting how people were so resonant. They so, oh, that's, I'm so frightened. I'm so traumatized. I'm so scared by what's happening. And Joy said she's in conversations with people and didn't know what they thought. And eventually she found out and took a breath, not knowing what they would say. And she walked into a Wawa to get something for my son. And she got confronted with a worker there. Oh, you're from Washington. Ah, they're all corrupt in Washington. All the politicians are corrupt. Ah. And so she was trying to deal with all that. So we've got people, Daniel, as you know better than I, people in this country are now living in parallel universes of information. Parallel universes. And they don't even hear the same stories or the same. We listened to Walter Cronkite half hour only a day of news after dinner every night. My family back in the day, that's how old I am. And he always said, and that's the way it is. And so you might not like the news or even his perspective, but most Americans had a sense of that's the way it was. That's not true anymore. News networks and radio and websites are deliberately peddling and with sophisticated algorithms, false information, disinformation, designed to confuse and take over. And the chapter I do in the book on text, and the one that's on truth is with Jesus, where you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. He didn't say you'll know the truth and you'll lie less often. The opposite of truth is captivity. Truth and freedom are indispensable. And that's what I think we're facing, a lot of captivity. And sometimes, you know, that can happen on lots of sides of the spectrum, demonizing and blaming the other and not trying to understand the other and not to otherize people, which is what the Good Samaritan parable is about, which I think could help lead the way to multiracial democracy. Here was a man who's on the side of the road, Jewish, and here's this Samaritan, and the Judeans didn't think there were any good Samaritans. They were like in cartels and coming with drugs. Oh, that's some other group we hear about. So that's how they were talking about. And here's an other, a Samaritan, who's other to the man on the side of the road. And the other stops to help one who's other to him. And John Meacham says so well, we have to turn enemies into neighbors. We can be political adversaries, but we have to become neighbors again. So I think you're neighbor often doesn't live inside your neighborhood. You got to go outside your neighborhood to see your neighbor. That insight from the Good Samaritan can teach us how to go forward into a multiracial democracy. The question the lawyer asked of Jesus was the most important question for our democracy today. Who is my neighbor? I joke that I think it was a Washington lawyer because I know that tone of voice. Not who is my neighbor, but exactly who is my neighbor? Who do I have an obligation to? So I think these biblical texts can bring us back to ancient truths that can be reframed and refreshed in our time in this moment of terrible crisis.
So I do want to talk about those texts and how you chose them, but I'm interested in the beginning of the book. You start with a pretty interesting window into the problem, in that it's a meeting of pastors in Atlanta. It's a diverse group of people. And some of them are willing and able to move forward with the multiracial democracy as soon as possible. And others, particularly white pastors from mainline Protestant denominations and others, are somewhat, I guess they see obstacles in their own congregation. And I'm wondering, why did you start the book there? What does that tell us about just the landscape of American Christianity that this book is landing into?
Yeah, they actually were feeling the word, I would say, is risk to themselves, not just obstacles, but risk. I was speaking at the Candler Theological Seminary down there at Emory, and we broke it down the next day with a bunch of pastors who'd come to the lecture the night before, and now we were unpacking it. And a lot of Black pastors in the room felt really, because of the night before in that session with their colleagues, felt emboldened to say what they really felt down deep. And often Black pastors in even ecumenical contexts don't feel free to say what they really think. They were pleading with these younger white pastors. You see, these were all young pastors, the whole group, and pleading with them to tell the truth about racism, about what's happening. Now, these are, you know, young white pastors, probably most of them had Black Lives Matter signs on their front lawns, right? They agreed with the Black pastors. They were with them in what was happening, and they wanted to show their support and solidarity. But their questions were all about the risk to me. This young woman said, female pastor, I need my parsonage for my raising my kids. Others said, I need a job. I need my pension. I could lose my congregation. I could lose my job. I could lose my career, because they talked about reactions and not just emails, not liking a pastor's sermon, saying it was too political or something. But pastors that have talked to me are getting death threats when they raise these issues. And the polarization in the country, which is so deep, is also happening in churches. And so pleading from Black pastors, feeling of risk from these white pastors, was a very powerful moment for me. And that's why I started with that story. And one of them raised Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the young German pastor who led the Confessing Church in Germany in the 1930s. And we talked about this as potentially a Bonhoeffer moment of that kind of need for getting back to faith and the distortion of faith and the subversion of religion for political power and for dictatorship. And so it was a powerful moment that was personal for all these pastors. How would they respond? And were they willing to trust their faith and trust their God enough to speak the truth, knowing they might lose lots of things, but they wouldn't lose themselves? And one of them said, didn't Bonhoeffer say something when Christ calls man, he bids him come and die? I said, yeah, he did say that. So what the risk will be here to them isn't clear. And it's how to go forward knowing there are risks involved. And as you pointed out before, the risks aren't just rhetorical now. I talk about Rachel Kleinfeld and the rising, tremendous skyrocketing of political violence in this country, threats and violence at every level. And people are feeling that. I talked to an election commissioner in a battleground state for one of the biggest counties in the country. And I said, what do you lose sleep over at night? And he said, he's an election commissioner. He says, the safety of my staff. Why would the safety of poll workers and people who are just taking and counting votes, why would their security be in danger? And he's most worried about the safety of staff. So safety and security and future are all at stake. So it's truth and risk-taking at the same time.
It's really interesting that you present the scene of the pastors in Atlanta who are wringing their hands about what to do, and contrast that image with the people, the rioters on January 6th, who knew exactly what they wanted to do. And they carried the Jesus Saves banners and they prayed on the Senate floor. And it is a reminder of the poetic line about having the worst among us are full of this passionate intensity. And you say in the book that Jesus is a victim of identity theft. I'm wondering, you know, contrast that image of those pastors in Atlanta versus what you saw on January 6th.
Yeah, the identity theft, Daniel, it was most evident to me on January 6th when these insurrectionists shouting Jesus' name as they violently took the Capitol and the Senate floor and the way they were praying as they took over. Praying as they took over, and they used Jesus' name. And I think those images really struck me very deeply. The violence, for sure, but the distortion of who Jesus is and who he still is and what he's saying to us now. So I think that's a great question. The pastors, there were Christians there, some pastors there, and some of them were working, linking with the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, your Christian pastors working with violent hate groups. And I think those pastors and the ones that I talked to in Atlanta are afraid of each other, for sure. They're afraid of each other. And they're afraid of the confrontations to come and all this talk in the air, politics and violence and bloodbaths after the election. That was this week's conversation. People are afraid there may be violence no matter what happens, no matter how the election turns out, either way in the fall. And we in the faith community, a lot of us, we had a retreat, Daniel, you were there, of faith leaders, and we actually went through scenarios of what kind of violence could occur and how we could intervene as faith leaders to try and to de-escalate confrontation, conflict. But I think those pastors are at odds. And the only way that I know how to have a conversation is to say, okay, here's what Jesus said. What did that mean? Do we believe that or not? If you have a different sense of what that means, let's talk about that. Let's have a serious conversation about that. And getting people to talk to each other. I have a dear friend in Detroit, Black pastor, and he's actually hosting our event in Detroit in the first week of the book tour. And he was in Lansing for one of these great rallies of the far right. And he was taking somebody to his car to keep him safe. And then he decided, a Black pastor with his collar on, to walk through the crowd of all these white Christian nationalists, many of whom were religious. And he's a very brave man. He walked through the crowd by himself, no entourage, no defense. And he began talking to people. Why are you here? Well, but why are you here as a Christian, as a pastor? Well, I was told we had to come. And he got into the, and he's sitting, standing there by himself, surrounded by these pastors, and they're having a conversation. And in that case, he was risking his life, really, but that led to some dialogue. And it's some conversations that have continued since he was there on the Capitol steps of Lansing having this dialogue. So I'm hoping this book can be a conversation starter. Publishers Weekly said it promises to be. Well, I hope and pray it is. How can we have a conversation starter? And in these next few months, we better have these conversations, because I like pointing out the difference between those pastors in Atlanta who were struggling and those in Washington we all saw who were fighting. They thought fighting for their faith. What kind of faith? What does our faith mean? What does it mean to be peacemakers? Not just peace lovers or peacekeepers, but peacemakers means conflict resolvers. How do we be those kind of peacemakers? Now, Jesus said, He gave a special designation to the peacemakers. They shall be called the children of God. At a time like this, I can see why.
Absolutely. So, Jim, one of the things that you do in this book is take six key texts from the Bible, and you, as you say, you aim to refresh and reframe them. And I'm just wondering, how did you choose these six particular texts? And you don't have to go through each of them, but just, are these the kind of touchstones that you live with? How do they speak to us right now?
Yeah, well, these are texts that are going to be familiar to certainly the listeners of this Soul of a Nation podcast, and they were to me, but they just struck me as so much speaking to this moment. So I try to apply them. I reread the texts and all the commentaries about them, and I wrestled and thought and prayed over them, and I try to take myself deeper into these texts. And like, for example, the first book of the Bible in Genesis 1:26, I was thinking as I read that text, the first line, which just jumped out at me. I feel, Daniel, surrounded by political noise all the time. It's kind of part of my vocation to be surrounded, to hear all the noise and then try and discern and bring perspective to it. But sometimes I feel overwhelmed by all that noise. And the text says, then God said, in other words, all that noise, be quiet. Here's what God says. And then it says, let us make humankind in our own image, according to our own likeness. This is the bedrock for any earthly talk about, you know, human rights or civil rights, and I apply it to voting rights in particular. I won't go into any depth on that, but I end up saying on these calls we have around the country with people trying to save democracy, I'm always supposed to speak to this text, and I say, well, to suppress a vote or deny a vote or block a vote or not count a vote because of the color of one's skin or any other reason is literally an assault on Imago Dei, an attack on Imago Dei, the image of God. And we're trying to take things deeper than politics. The image of God is at stake in this movement we have, Face United Save Democracy, in 10 key states where voter suppression is really on the rise. I call it the Imago Dei movement. We're trying to be an Imago Dei movement here. So that text is so foundational to all of this and to voting rights. And you know, the Good Samaritan, I talked about that a moment ago. It's Luke 10:25-37. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And then his example of who a good neighbor is was very subversive in that day, very controversial. The Samaritan was not the religious leaders who passed by the man beaten and half dead on the side of the road, but this Samaritan. And I think the Good Samaritan, I lay out, could really help us spiritually navigate how to move into a multiracial democracy. But for many of us, it's undergirded by what Dr. King and John Lewis called the beloved community. What does it mean to be a beloved community across all those boundaries as a foundation for multiracial democracy in this country?
One of the striking things about your book is that you provide this history of where white Christian nationalism came from, its deep roots in this country. You quote historians and sociologists who have studied this. You cite examples of slave owners who chose politics and profit over the Bible by, as you note, pulling parts out of the Bible that suggested people were equal, including the passage, I believe, in Genesis that you mentioned. So Americans, it seems from the very start, have been pretty good at just discarding the parts of the Bible that call on them to act like Jesus. And I'm wondering, given that history, what gives you hope that now would be different?
One of the scriptures that has been removed from all the slaveholder Bibles is one of these texts that I talk about in the book, Galatians 3:28. There's no longer Jew or Gentile. There's no longer slave or free. There's no longer male or female, for all of you are one in Christ. And what I discovered in studying this as deeply as I could, this was a baptismal rite, a baptismal formula in the early church, read at every single baptism. And that text was taken out of all the slaveholder Bibles because they were saying, in effect, and I wish, you know, the American church and all of our baptists would say the same thing. They were saying, in effect, so this Jesus who we follow, this itinerant rabbi who we follow, he's taught us we have to overcome these pillars, these decisive barriers of oppression and division of race, class, and gender. All three are always involved in every situation. But we're called to overcome those, transcend those, and come together. Now, we don't always do it best or right, or we make mistakes, but this is our vocation, our calling. It's not just extracurricular. And so if you don't want to be a part of that kind of community, you better go somewhere else. That's what they were saying. I wish we were saying that in the American churches. So that text is so foundational to where we are and where we could be. Dr. King always talked about the churches should be a model. So that text, he loved that text. That should be a model for our aspirations, not just for the church, but in the larger society. And so I try and go deeper in these texts for me and then say what it has to say to us now. And your big question, I don't know, Daniel. I don't know if we believe these texts or not, and how many Christians will decide if these texts make a difference or not. I know this is a choice point. This is a decision time. And all I can do is lift up these texts and these questions, and it's going to be up to a lot of us, whether we're Christians or not, even people who are Jewish, Muslim, or not any kind of faith. I think there's going to be a faith factor, Daniel, in this election, not just political factors, but a faith factor. This book is about the faith factor. How can we bring the faith factor to bear, and something very different than white Christian nationalism? So I hope and pray this is one of those times when everything is going to be changed by what we decide. So it's not just here we go again. It's here we are. Here we are. Who are we? What do we believe? And what do we mean by our faith? And I love the text from Jesus. He says, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I tell you?" That's pretty relevant now. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I say? And the violence, the trajectory that's being used now of fear leading to hate, leading to violence. That's not what Jesus taught us. So what does a politics of love, what does a politics of neighbor love from the Good Samaritan mean right now? So all we can do is raise these up and say we all have to make these choices.
So Jim, I wanted to ask you about another text that appears in the book that I know has been really important to you and your life and your ministry, and that is Matthew 25. A lot of people will know it as Jesus' test of discipleship, but you go further and take it into politics. And I'm wondering, tell us about that text and tell us why you see it important, not only just to Christians, but to anyone who's looking to build this multiracial democracy in the United States.
Well, it's my conversion text. And the book is it's very personal, this book. It's sort of the closest to a memoir I've ever come. And I talk about how when I was, you know, really kicked out of my home church in Detroit, Evangelical Church, over these issues of race and poverty and war, and I became very secular. I became a student activist at Michigan State, and I left my faith behind. What an elder told me, Christianity, son, has nothing to do with racism. That's political, and our faith is personal. And it was that conversation I just said, I'm done. Because this thing that was ripping me up, tearing me apart, turning me upside down, this thing really big and really wrong in my white Detroit world and white school and white church, if that's got nothing to do with faith, then I want nothing to do with that kind of faith either. So I became very secular. and left it all behind. And so I was reading, at the time, we all were reading Karl Marx, Che Guevara, and Ho Chi Minh. But they weren't satisfying to me. Finally, I needed something deeper, a better foundation. I decided I wanted to be, you know, an activist for my life and try and change things. But I didn't have an adequate foundation. So I probably never got shed of Jesus, though the church shed itself of me. And so I, after organizing the student strike in 1970 and shutting down Michigan State University, like lots of us did to our schools, and coming to Washington, I came back to reflect on Jesus. And I started in the Gospels, and I read things I had never heard in church. The Sermon on the Mount, the basic catechism of Jesus, his teaching for new disciples, it was never a sermon in my church. But then I got to this text, Matthew 25. As you have done this to the least of these, you have done this to me. So I call it the "it was me" text. I was hungry. I was thirsty. I was naked. I was a stranger. The word stranger there means immigrant, literally. I was sick. I was in prison. It was me. So when a mother in Flint, Michigan can't provide water for her kids without asbestos to do them brain damage, and the white mothers in suburban Flint have no problem, Jesus is saying, that mother was me, that black mother in the city of Flint, that was me. When we caged migrant kids and took them away from their parents and put them in separate cages, we're literally caging Jesus there. When we deny to help impoverished families, a mom again working three jobs and still needing food stamps, and we're cutting food stamps, Jesus is saying, that was me. I was that mom who still needed food stamps. So you can go all through the text here, and he's saying, it was me. That was the most radical thing I'd ever read, much more than all the revolutionary stuff I was reading. That was it. And so I signed up, and it was Dorothy Day, Catholic worker, became a mentor and model for me before she died, and that was her conversion text. It's what always brings me back. It converts me over and over again. That the way to find Jesus is to go to the edges, the margins. Where the poor and most vulnerable, that's where you're going to find Jesus. The text is, that's where you'll find me. That's where I am. How much you serve them, he says, is how much you love me. So as Daniel, you know, we take this to Capitol Hill, and this economics of Jesus turns our politics literally upside down. And we've used this text in the White House, in the Congress, and it's a total reversal of Washington politics about who or what is important. So that text for me was Jesus' final talk, his final teaching before going in to Jerusalem to be crucified and resurrected. So I call it the final test of discipleship. Jesus is not generally judgmental, like a lot of Christians are today. But this text is pretty tough. The sheep and the goats. And they all thought they belonged to Jesus. They all thought they were his followers. They were obeying the rules, and they thought they were fine. And they all said, when do we see you hungry and thirsty and naked and sick and in prison? They're saying, we didn't know it was you. And had we known, we would have formed a social action committee in our church or something, right? He says, yeah, it was me. And as you've done to the least of these, you've done to me. That just turned me around, brought me to faith, and continues to convert me to this day.
Well, Jim, I wanted to thank you for your time and to circle back to what we started with hope. And you mentioned that it's a crucial time in American history. It's a perilous time in American history. What gives you hope as we look ahead to 2024?
Well, this is an Easter book coming out the Tuesday after Easter. So for me, it's an Easter book. It's about resistance and hope at the same time. And it's interesting. It always comes up again at this event with Brittany Packnett just last night. She was asked the students, how do you have hope? Where's your hope, given all that's going on? And her answer really speaks to my answer to this too. She said, I don't have any other choice but to hope. My ancestors She talked about her great-great-great-grandmother and how she kept the family together during and after slavery. I don't have any choice but to hope that people, it'd be betraying my ancestors not to have hope. Now, she's very realistic about what we're facing, and I am too. And I don't, as someone said, don't mince words in this book. That's probably fair. But I think it's got to be this choice that we help people to see what is possible and how we're going to be faithful, genuinely faithful, at a time like this. Now, the book's dedicated to a new generation, my sons, Luke and Jack, and my new daughter-in-law, Anna Sophia, and all my students. I was with them yesterday, and I'll tell you, every time I'm with those two, it's the best part of my week. And former students and current students, I brought to hear Brittany Packnett for their class. And I'll tell you, I think this new generation is going to significantly change some things. I really do. And a new generation, and a minority, I'll say probably a minority of white believers, but a lot of younger white believers are going to stand alongside, join with black and brown church leaders to create a new American church, which I call not a confessing church like Bonhoeffer, but our own version of that, which I call a remnant church, where we join together, not just to say what we're against. This book is also about what we're for. How can we create something new? Literally a new American church that reaches out to other faith traditions and a whole new generation not in church. Most of my students are in the none of the above category, and yet they're drawn to this. What they're drawn to is authenticity and courage. That's what they're drawn to. So I don't know how that, I don't know how to quantify that for an election or how to quantify that with electoral votes in six key battleground states. That's beyond my capacity. But I think long-term, I'm hopeful with this new generation that I'm with. I love being in Georgetown, and I love mostly being with these young people. And I'm with them all the time. And I was with them yesterday with Brittany Packnett. And it was a wonderful time to see how their hope rose in the conversation. And so we're going to work hard to make that make a difference in an election. But beyond that, I think we have no choice but to hope, because that's what it means to be a believer in God.
And Jim, finally, and thank you for this, but can you, you've mentioned several times in conversations with me, your book tour, and people listening to this might be curious about some of the cities where you might be going.
Sure.
Well, you don't have to rattle off the whole list, but can you give us some of the places and regions that you'll be going so people, listeners, can stop by and see you in person if they wanted to?
Yeah, we finally have a composite schedule. It's, I want to turn a book tour into a town meeting tour. So it isn't just a book and an author. It's a conversation about faith and democracy. And so when they asked me where I want to go, I said, sure, I'll do the, you know, the usual cities, New York and Washington. But then I said, I want to go to Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, not just. So we're going to Atlanta the first week, which is Georgia, a very key state at the Carter Center. We're going to my hometown of Detroit and then Grand Rapids right there in Michigan, too, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This is all the first week of the tour. And then Chicago. And we are doing Boston. And we're doing the West Coast, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. But other places now are coming in and wanting something too, like North Carolina and Texas. And so, but we're going to places where this critical moment will be decided. and I want to have these conversations right there. And we're going to all those cities, and people, if they want to get the link, they can see when we're coming there. But there's, in every city, I've chosen somebody who's a moderator, who's local, or a respondent. Kristen Dumay, who wrote Jesus and John Wayne, will be in Grand Rapids, Calvin College, where she teaches. So I've got all these. Bob Franklin is going to be the moderator of the Carter Center, and my dear friend, former President Morehouse. So in every case, there's a local moderator or a group or of responders, and we're going to have a conversation. Not just about an author and a book, but about where we are at this moment. So I don't know where that's going to lead or take, but so far I'm really grateful for the interest in various cities and the organizing that's going on. And we're going to try and, not just a book tour, but a town meeting tour. And it won't just be the first 2-3 weeks. I'll go through the spring and through the summer and the fall until the election.
That's great. And listeners, we will put a link to Jim's website where you'll be able to see all of the stops on the town hall / book tour in the show notes to this podcast episode. So if you look on whatever podcast player you use in the description of this episode, we will put a link to all of the things that Jim mentioned, a link to his book, a link to the Center on Faith and Justice. And Jim, thank you. I hope this wasn't too painful.
No, you've always got good questions, Daniel. That's why I asked you to be our comm director. You always have good questions. So thanks for that again today. For more Soul of the Nation updates, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review, and follow me on Twitter @JimWallace if you like. Blessings for the Soul of the Nation. Thank you all.